You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 15th of June 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio 2 at Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Gillian DeBias.
And coming up on today's programme, we'll be welcoming our Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana, into the studio to give us his take on recent film and literary festivals in Palestine, including his top picks from both.
She's giving birth right now. We need to get through to that hospital.
Step out.
What? You're not? I'm talking to him.
I told you to step out right now.
Outside the studios here at Midori House, it's Monocle Country Fair time, and we'll be bringing a bit of the fair into the studio. Alan Schofield from Honest John's Record will be picking out some tracks for us from his stall, including this.
Music is the
And we'll be crossing to New York for some top tips for the weekend, plus asking why American theatre is doing so well in London's West End with friend of the show, Matt Wolfe.
So, as ever, lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. So, welcome one and all. A very special day here at Midori House, because not only is it The Review, but Gillian, as we were just mentioning earlier, it's the Monocle Country Fair happening right outside these very doors.
All the fun at the fair. I've just had a quick spin, and although I'm looking forward to this hour, I can't wait to get out to the petting zoo and the bunting and the Swedish garlands.
Well, you mentioned the petting zoo. One highlight I think I must flag up for later in the day. I reckon around sort of 1500 hours time, London time, we will be doing what has become now tradition.
Your tradition, Steve Bloomfield.
of interviewing the animals in the petting zoo, or certainly the handlers of the animals. So last Christmas it was the reindeer and the reindeer handlers and the antlers.
So who do you have your eye and your microphone on this year, do you think?
Well, we've got goats, mm-hmm. baby goats, we've got lambs, there's a little bunny rabbit, there's some chicks as well, two pigs.
Two pigs. They're called Kuni Kuni pigs from New Zealand.
Kuni pigs.
Kuni
is that right?
Pigs, yes,
okay. Well, I need to do more research then before I head out there.
Yeah, before you interview them, Steve.
Indeed. And of course, in that we've got Daunt Books, we've got Honest John's as well, and Alan Schofield, as we've said, from Honest John's, will be in here a little bit later. But for now, you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
And it is a special review today, because not only is the Monocle Country Fair taking place at this very moment outside in our courtyard, but also we're welcoming to London a selection of our correspondents from around the world.
And one of those correspondents is Joseph Dana, our man in Jerusalem, who, while not busy providing us with his excellent range of reporting from the region, did you write this, Joseph? has also found time recently to attend the Palestinian Festival of Literature, which took place in the last week of May, and also the Franco-Arab Film Festival, which wraps up this weekend.
And so, to tell us more about these events and his top picks from both, he joins us in studio. Welcome, Joseph.
Thank you very much.
So it seems like sort of festival season you're a part of town.
It is. It's always interesting to kind of partake in these cultural events, which tend to be gaining a lot of steam in over the last couple of years in Palestine. I mean, in Israel, of course, there's a lot of culture going on. There's a lot of music going on. There's a lot of book discussion going on. But in Palestine, we don't really hear about it that much. And so the Palestinian Festival of Literature, as well as this Franco-Arab Film Festival, was a very welcome addition to the skew, as it were.
And let's talk about PALFEST, as the Palestinian Festival of Literature is known by some. Is it just taking place in the West Bank, or is it in Gaza as well? And how does that work?
Well, it's been going on for quite a while now. I think it's in its fifth or sixth year, something around there. And last year, they had a number of problems actually setting up events in Gaza. And they had a couple of problems in the West Bank as well. And so this year, they had a much better organizing committee. And they had events in Israel, in Haifa. They had events all over the West Bank and events in Gaza. And so the Gazan events really got the most kind of attention. And there was a very strongly political bent to it, which it's not always so nice to have you know, that marriage between art and politics. So
sometimes you just want the art, actually, for a festival like this.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You say that, but then again, what is going to make your festival different? You know, if you are a director of a festival in that region, surely you can't ignore the politics, even if it is a cultural event.
Well, this is exactly the line that that's so difficult to kind of walk. I find that, you know, in Palestine, the political situation does absolutely drive artistic development going there. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And to kind of showcase that as a part of a festival would be quite nice, have a, you know, a kind of political day or something like this. But when the entire festival is kind of draped in this language of, you know, resistance through cultural production and things like that, it just gets exhausting, to be quite honest.
Let's talk about the other festival as well, the Franco-Arab Film Festival. In what way do you feel this has sort of added to the the cultural vista in Palestine?
Well, the Franco, it's very interesting. The German and the French, the Germans and the French are very active in Palestinian civil society. And I think it's a very good exercise of soft power, to be honest. There's a Franco-German cultural center. It's basically the Goethe Institute and the French
Institute. Alliance Française.
Exactly. And they've been, I would say, in the last year, really kind of upping their game when it comes to cultural events in Palestine. And so the Franco-Arab Film Festival, which kind of took place last week, is definitely the latest in that trend. And it's always nice to see all of the diplomatic corps kind of come out for these things as well. And so here we have almost the opposite of the Palestinian Festival of Literature, in which diplomats go out to see movies and then everyone goes out for a coffee or a beer or something like that. And it's a nice kind of evening of culture. Some of the films tend to be very political themselves, but it's not this, you know, resistance through kind of cultural production and we have to talk about politics all the time.
So what film stuck out for you?
Well, there's a Canadian film actually called Inshallah, which means God willing, and anyone that's ever been to the Middle East knows that that's a word that everyone's using every second minute, basically. And it's a very interesting film because it deals directly with this issue of what does it mean to be a foreigner in a foreign land and how do you immerse yourself in that kind of experience.
Should we have a little listen to that?
Right now, we need to get through to that hospital.
Step out.
What? You're not. I'm talking to him.
I told you to step out right now.
So that was a clip from Inshallah. What sort of reaction did that film get when it was put on at the festival?
It was a very warm reaction. The film is about a Canadian doctor that lives in a refugee camp. In the West Bank. It's kind of nondescript. And as she's there performing her, you know, kind of medicine and whatnot, she becomes increasingly involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And so, you know, with an audience of diplomats and journalists and mostly foreigners as well as Palestinians, this, I think, really spoke to people. I know that it spoke to me personally in terms of, you know, you're in the middle of this very dramatic conflict and yet you are not a part of it. And how that line, how you interact with that experience, I think is incredibly fascinating.
And were there other films that sort of took on themes of the region that you saw?
There were a couple of films that were quite popular in Cannes, from what I understand. I didn't have a chance to go and see the other films, but you know, I can tell you that the entire week, everybody was buzzing about this festival, which was a really nice welcome. And people were chatting, oh, this film, you know, did really well in Cannes. We have to see this. This is by this Arab director from Lebanon. We have to see this. And so, again, it's also this layer of bringing Palestine into the Middle East. Sometimes it feels very disconnected, this kind of remote area that's, you know, embroiled in conflict, and those connections with Lebanon and with Egypt and with Syria and things like that are nice.
And I suppose also with festivals like this, it's not just about, you know, the films and the books and the talks all necessarily making a point about what's going on there, but it's in a sense about having a feeling of normality that, well, this is a normal place where we have literature festivals and we bring in authors from all over the world. And, you know, one of those authors, for example, China Mavel, who, you know, came to Palestine for the for PALFest, you know, doesn't write about Palestine, doesn't write about political issues in that sort of, in such a, you know, an overt way. How did his talk go down?
His was very interesting. He actually I heard him speak in Nablus, and he did another event, which I really wanted to go to, in which he performed this book called The City and the City with a very famous Palestinian actor. Now, this book itself is an absolutely brilliant, it's almost a guide for Palestine in a sort of way. It's a science fiction book. I don't personally like science fiction that much. I always find it to be like very odd, and you know, they have conventions somewhere in Oklahoma or something. It's like very weird.
Yeah, but there's sort of science fiction in terms of films, and then there's, you know, J.G. Ballard, there's Neil Gaiman, there's sort of that sort of fantasy, which is obviously, you know, far more literary and far more political.
Absolutely, and that's where this book comes in. Just to give you a brief kind of synopsis, what it is, it's about a city, or rather two cities that occupy the same geographical space. And through subtle differences in architecture and dress and things like that, people try and differentiate themselves and lay their claim to this same space. Now, anyone that's ever been to Hebron in the West Bank, this is exactly, it's almost as if it was written about Hebron. You know, you have this famous mosque in the middle, or some people call it a synagogue, right? The Ibrahimi Mosque, or the Tomb of the Patriarchs, where Abraham and the patriarchs are rumored to be buried. And it's the same building. And yet there's a dividing line between it, basically, and with two different names, with two different styles of architecture, just right down the middle. And so I found it to be very interesting to kind of unpack this in that region.
But talk a little bit more about the city and the city, because I was trying to read the synopsis and it was almost losing me, but I just knew there were some great kind of urban ideas and metaphors there. But what's at the core of this book?
Well, I think that the core, I can't really speak to his motivations, but this is a writer that definitely has been to Israel, Palestine. And there's, I think there's no way that he could have not had this in his mind when he was writing about it. Now, it's science fiction and it's a detective story. There's a murder in one part of the city, and a detective has to go in, and then through that kind of process of trying to solve this murder, he's able to kind of lay the setting of how this this city and the city operates.
But each citizen of the city can't acknowledge the other city. That's what I was finding so bizarre about how you know, when citizens recognize the other city, they're kind of almost like frozen or.
And that's exactly why it's so brilliant for the Israeli and Palestinian situation, in which, you know, you have two people living on the same plot of land that can't recognize each other.
When, you know, festivals are held, arts festivals are held in Palestine, do you get the feeling that there is strong local involvement, that there is a real sort of promotion of local culture or arts? Or is there a tendency amongst organizers to think, we'll bring in people from outside, we'll bring in some big name authors, some films that are going to be on at Cannes, and that's what we're going to do to sort of boost the popularity of our event?
I think both things are going on. There was a lovely art festival that we actually covered on Monocle called Kalandia International, which was all about promoting local Palestinian art. And yes, there is a lot of local Palestinian art and culture. And so, again, this is where I kind of have some criticism about the Palestinian Festival of Literature, in which it does have that very strong feeling of, we're going to bring in the internationals,
yeah, mm-hmm,
and we're going to say, okay, you know, we support Palestine, and you know, this is a great testament of,
and we're going to show how we support Palestine by bringing in the biggest names we can possibly find.
Absolutely. And so you have to strike a balance, and I think that they're working it out, especially in the artistic realm.
So in both festivals, is there a means to support new emerging talent, whether it's new filmmakers or new writers from the region? Is that sort of part of it, or totally separate from these festivals?
I think it definitely plays a role in it. And again, this is where the Germans and the French are really exerting, I think, an excellent use of soft power in support of the arts and in support of these types of festivals, and really promoting them a lot and making sure that their diplomats and their journalists are going to these events and talking about these events and drawing that connection between, you know, Europe and the beleaguered Palestinian people.
Joseph Dana, we're going to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Very good to see you here in the studio at Midori House. You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24. After this short break, we'll be crossing over to Nelly Gotcheva for her weekly weekend roundup from around the world.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
You can be European, meaning reliable, responsible. You believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values, too.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
It's not like New York, because New York, it's like you can walk to Central Park, you can walk anywhere you want. There's an urban continuity. In here, you have to get into a car or get into something that moves and get out of here.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24. Brought to you in association with Rolex.
Come with us from
Georgia
before we zip to
Istanbul
on Route 4 as we meet the people who are charting, finessing, celebrating and refreshing our metropolises.
You have to design a street for the speed at which a human being walks rather than for the automobile.
If you're trying to look at this place as an organ, it doesn't get enough blood. So it's on the verge of a heart attack, I'd say.
What's always attracted me about the square is that it is a London organism. It's something that's peculiar to this city.
The Urbanist is Monocle 24's show about the cities we live in, that delivers insights into city halls, the views from the tops of towers, the stories of hidden rivers, and discovers why we still love that brutalist old beast, concrete.
Everything we use, touch, and our entire economy is based upon nature. The only difference now is that we tend to be less able to see that because we're living in a world of concrete, glass, and steel.
The Urbanist, presented by me, Andrew Tuck, premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time.
How far is the park? Does the park have a place where they can sit? Does the park have shade for them?
Join your fellow city lovers and leave the countryside to the people who prefer barns to bars and quiet walks to sidewalks.
Welcome back to Studio 2, and you are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias and Steve Bloomfield. And we're going to cross over now to our Toronto Bureau Chief, Nelly Gocheva, for her top tips for the weekend.
This weekend, we invite you to our own Summer Country Fair, featuring Monaco's favorite nations and retailers. A petting zoo, our own Moscow Monochan, and live music by Giorgio Manzio, Ian Shaw, and DJ Satoshi will be at Midori House to entertain all visitors. Exclusive stall holders include Henchman, Drake's London, Trunk, Town Books, and the embassies of Colombia and Sweden. The Monaco Country Fair is at Midori House on 1 Dorset Street. And if in Tokyo this weekend, stop by Hara Museum of Contemporary Art to see the works of French artist Sophie Calle. We recommend Voir la Mer, a film installation capturing people's first encounters with the ocean. Entitled For the Last and First Time, the show is on until the end of June. In Montreal, the Museum of Fine Art is showcasing four installations by American artist and master manipulator of glass, Dale Chiholi. Specially crafted for the show, the works create joyful yet bizarre world of shapes, colors and textures. Chiholi is at Montreal Museum of Fine Art until the 20th of October. Art Museum hosts Cyclopedia. On display are 40 bicycles with great design, curated by Vienna-based interior designer and bike collector Maiko Embacher. A must for bike lovers this Saturday is the Summer Joyride, a tour around America's bicycle capital. Cyclopedia is on until the 8th of September, while the Summer Joyrides are scheduled for this and next Saturday, with more to follow in July and August. Taking over Brooklyn over the next few days is the Northside Festival. Local music favorites The Walkmen are set to headline Williamsburg's McCarran Pool Park on Saturday, while Solange takes the stage on Sunday, with over 350 bands playing at smaller venues. The Northside Festival is at various venues across Brooklyn until Thursday. For more information, go to northsidefestival.com. And now let's hear Solange with Losing You. For Monaco, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That's the superior Noel sister ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
And it's time now for our weekly music review. And today we're bringing the Monocle Country Fair into the studio. Just outside our studios here at Midori House, music lovers are currently hanging out at the stall of Honest John's, a record store normally firmly rooted in Portobello Road, Notting Hill.
But for this weekend, they've packed up some of their finest vinyl and CDs and set up shop here at Midori House. And I'm delighted to welcome back Alan Schofield from Honest John's to the review, who's here to tell us what's on offer. Alan, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, first of all, for those that don't know Honest John's, give us a little bit of a potted history.
Well, it's 40 years old next year. So it's been around maybe one of the oldest record stores in the country. I think there might be one or two that are older, but not many that have lasted that long. And it started in Goulburn Road, just around the corner from where we are. A guy called John Clare, who's still our friend and landlord. But for 20 years, my friend and partner Mark and I have owned it. Mark and I are here today.
And Notting Hill, with sort of Rough Trade and Honest John's, it's a very good home for independent record stores. What's it about that community?
Well, it's always had a sort of bohemian element, I think, certainly since the war. I think in the 50s and 60s, there were artists living there and musicians, and there's something arty in the air. But also, very importantly, it was where a lot of West Indian people came, for instance, a lot of Spanish people, a lot of Arab and North African people. So there's a healthy cultural mix, and that helps when you have a record store.
And now, if we'd been having this conversation 10 years ago and we'd be talking about, you know, the health of music and music shops, we'd be saying that, you know, guys like you might be in a bit of trouble, you know, and all the big boys would soon be driving you out of town.
Yeah.
And now we look around our high streets and our price is long gone, Woolworths is long gone, HMV is going gone. And yet, you know, some of the best independent record stores are still there. Why do you think that is?
First of all, it was a terribly grim period at the sort of around the turn of the century when downloads came in and Amazon started, you know, fierce price cuts and stuff. And it was a dreadful time for, you know, the little guys like us. It felt like it at the time. But as you say, strangely, we've sort of used, I think, some of the technological changes, like having a website, means now that we are international. And we're not just relying on people to walk into the store or in Portobello Road. We have a very busy site, you know, and things like that. But I think at some point, the world sort of woke up and figured that, having lost hundreds and hundreds of record stores in the UK, I think there was a sort of general cultural sense that in the country that people didn't want to lose what record stores or good bookshops or whatever it was were offering. And we started getting busy again. And the last few years, we've been busier and busier. So it's an interesting
time. Well, it's like with records and music. I think, you know, that experience of actually choosing your record is really important, right the way down to what the cover looks like. And I was really pleased to see, you know, you've packed up your caravan, you've set up shop at the Monocle Country Fair. And it's not just CDs. You have boxes and boxes of vinyl.
Yeah. It's very tactile and visual. And it's all about that. And I think that's, you know, put that... physical element is what maybe is another way of putting what I just tried to say about how people felt like they were missing something in the digital age.
Discovery.
And touching and seeing and being with other people in a store, talking to people about music. You know, we always learn from our customers. That's the great thing about having a record shop. You learn about music. When I started there 25 years ago, my education was from the customers when it came to world music, like jazz and African music, for instance.
And now, in a moment, we're going to start listening to some of the selections you've brought in. But before we listen to the first track, I just wanted to ask you about how you go about choosing the music that you sell, because you've got an incredibly eclectic range from all across the world and from many different decades.
It's just really music we love. I mean, Mark and I met over a cup of tea and about 17 hours of listening to Reggae Sevens. And it's that was 30 years ago, and it just grows out of that, really. Love of music, love
of
discovery, lots of tea.
17 hours.
Yeah.
Should we start with your first track, Lord Kitchener? Tell us a bit about it before we play it.
Well, we started a label when, in the bad days 10 years ago when everything was falling apart. One of the things we did sort of almost unconsciously was to reach out and try and figure out other things we could do. And we started a record label with our friend Damon. And we've now done 60 or 70 albums or whatever it is. And our new, we have a series called London is the Place for Me, which is music recorded in London in the 50s and 60s. Mainly by people who weren't born here, but who came here from West Indies, Africa, etc. And this is a track by Lord Kitchener about the England tour of West Indies in 1953, when there was some controversy about the umpiring. And it's a very civilized and elegant song. And on our new release, London is the Place for Me, Volume 5.
The MCC proclaimed that they are not pleased about some unfair decision in the West Indies. The MCC proclaimed that they are not pleased about some unfair decision in the West Indies. Well, in the cricket season, these things always happen. So I'm asking you, please, don't put the blame on the West Indies. There was a big umpiring confusion about the disallow of Holt and Everton. But you cannot put the blame on the umpire, for it happens in England and Australia. The rules and regulation, no man condemned the umpire's decision. That's why I'm asking you, please, don't put the blame on the West Indies.
Love that. Lord Kitchener with cricket umpires.
Brilliant.
And possibly the best cricket song I think I've heard in a very, very long time.
There's some great cricket. That is a great song. And I was just did a little research into it was the Jamaica test, I believe, the first one. And in fact, there were people the West Indian fans were the ones who were causing the rumpus. And apparently the wife and daughter of the umpire were physically attacked or assaulted.
And this was at a time when in cricket there wasn't an independent umpire, so the home team would choose the umpire. So these were two West Indian umpires.
Yes, that's right.
Umpiring between West Indies and England. So there's always until that changed in the 90s, there was always scope for
blame.
Who was Lord Kitchener? What's his background?
A great Calypsonian, and he wrote the song "London is the Place for Me," which is the title of our series. And he came over in 1949 on the Windrush, and there's film footpath footage of him on the ship singing "London is the Place for Me" before he actually arrived in London. He sings this wonderful song about how beautiful it was and how great the people were, and et cetera, et cetera.
Did he do another follow-up a few years later saying,
I want to go back to Jamaica. I miss the West Indies.
Tell us about your second track and the background to that.
Well, this is 1976 in South Africa, and very important time. It's the time of the Soweto Uprising. And Donald Brand, who's changed his name to Abdul Ibrahim soon after this, who's a great, massive figure in the history of African jazz and jazz in general. And his wife, Bia Benjamin, made this record in, interestingly for me, it was the label was an offshoot of a record store in Johannesburg. And I think this is just a deep spiritual piece of music called music, and coming from a very troubled time. But it's so interesting to feel how spiritual and rich it is.
Thank you.
Pete Benjamin with Dollar Brand. That's music. And that was written around the time, well, sort of in the month leading up to the Soweto uprising.
The spring of 76, apparently. And I think the uprising was through the summer, or through the our summer, as it were.
So is that a reissue? Is it the fact that the original recordings don't exist anymore?
The original recording was, I think they made 200 copies or something. Mm. This is an insanely rare record. And a friend of ours, a South African guy who lives in London called Matt, has a small label and he's reissuing interesting South African records. And this has just come out a few weeks ago. And we're playing it a lot in the shop and it's just sort of setting the tone at the moment.
How do you go about finding some of these tracks? Particularly if you want to try and find the original, is it a lot of sort of, you know, friends of friends of friends and people put the word out?
Yeah, you sort of, I mean, one of the things, going back to our discussion about why are things a bit busier, you know, for record stores, is that I feel like there's a community now of the independents. And we all sort of know each other. And there's lots of small labels that do limited runs of very interesting things. And so it's a very interesting time to be, you know, having a shop because there's so much going on. There's lots and lots and lots of small runs. And, you know, we know this guy, Matt, he's a customer and so if we wanted to know something about or tried to release a South African record, we would call him up and he would probably know somebody who knew something or who had it, or you know what I'm saying? So it's just a very human touch.
It kind of reminds me of the community between like stamp collectors or coin collectors.
Yeah. And probably a few murders in there as well.
Let's move on to your third track, Theo Parrish and Tony Allen.
Right. Well, Theo and Tony are two legends of music. Tony Allen, of course, people will know was the drummer for Fela Kuti in Nigeria right through the 60s and 70s, and is still very busy and a great drummer. And Theo Parrish is a sort of god of Detroit techno music, a younger generation. Both friends of ours, we've put out records with both of them separately, but this is Theo's new label, Wild Heart, and first available maybe as a download, but we don't know about that. It's a 12-inch. There's no single. It's something that they put together and in London added some vocals from some young Londoners. And if I can express an interest, my son did the mix.
Excellent. So,
let's
have a listen.
Marriage of 60s African drumming, 20th century, 1990s Detroit techno and 21st century London vocals. That is Theo Parrish and Tony Allen with Day Like This. Before we end, tell us a bit about your own musical buying habits. Because, you know, at a time when, you know, obviously lots of people are, you know, returning to the idea of buying vinyl, but obviously, we've sort of moved on from downloading, and now most of us are just streaming. Does that worry you at all?
Yeah. No, very much. And I don't do it. I don't know how to do it, and it doesn't interest me at all. And I guess, you know, like I say, it feels healthy at the moment having the store, and there's a lot of people that like having the stuff. But I do wonder how long, you know, where we'll be in 10 years. I really do.
And what about the live performance? I mean, I was just listening to that and thought, you know, Theo Parrish and Tony Allen, I would love to hear them live.
Yeah.
What are the opportunities to hear?
Well, we do something. We've done something called the Chop Up, a couple of times with the Barbican producing it. And we went to New York with it 1 year, and we went to Marseille last time we did it. And Theo and Tony were on the last Chop Up last year. And that sort of consolidated that track in a way that we just listened to. So it's something, you know, we try and do in our own way, bring together lots of diverse, different people from all over the world and say, okay, let's have 3 days together and do a show. And new music and some old stuff as well. So, and there's so many festivals these days and there's so much going on. It is a healthy time, a great time to hear live stuff.
Tell us about your final track, DJ Rogers.
Funky Gospel. My son got me into this. He's a great digger for funky gospel.
You've got to bring your son in.
Yeah. You've got to get him in next time, Budgie. And he found this track, and it ended up on a friend of ours, Dave Hill's compilation. It's just 70s religious music, but boy, it kicks ass.
Well, Alan Schofield from Honest John's Records, thank you very much.
At the Monocle
indeed.
Fair now.
Indeed, thank you for joining us. If you are here, come down to the Monocle Fair. But if you're slightly further afield, you can, of course, go to honestjohns.com. That's J-O-N-S, no H in there. And this, to play us out, is DJ Rogers. All I Gave Him Was My Heart. Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
DJ Rogers, All I Gave Him Was My Heart on Monocle 24.
And moving right along, we know that there's a lot happening at Midori House in London today, but it's time now to step out of the studio and across the Atlantic to explore some cultural highlights for the weekend from another city around the globe. Today, we're crossing to New York, and our bureau editor, Santiago Tarditi, is here to guide us through it.
So you have just landed at JFK, dropped your bags at the hotel, and are ready to hit the streets. Welcome to New York. Make sure you wear comfy shoes. There's plenty to do. Start your weekend stroll with a visit to the best galleries in town, most of which lie in the Chelsea district. Clampart, established in the year 2000, is one of our favorite. Specializing in photography and modern and contemporary paintings from the 20th century, the gallery is currently hosting an exhibition that focuses on pictures taken in 1985. Check out what the city looked like 28 years ago through the images of Arlene Gottfried, Keizo Kitajima, and Brian Young, amongst others. It may be summer in New York, but up in Queens' MoMA PS1 Museum, it's raining. As part of the museum's Expo One exhibition that investigates the world's ecological challenges in the midst of the 21st century socio-political instability, the Rain Room installation, set up by the Random International Studio, is a 100-square-meter field of falling water that stops whenever visitors walk through it. Don't worry, you can leave the brolly at home. Enough art for now, it's time to dance. Take the train down to Brooklyn's recently opened Barclays Center, the home of the Brooklyn Nets basketball team, to catch the Postal Service live. The band will be celebrating its 10th anniversary and playing songs from their suitably named one and only album, Give Up. Feeling tired yet? Sorry, but you can't stop in New York. No snoozing allowed around here. Recharge your batteries with a late-night bite at East Village's iconic 24-hour restaurant, Veselka. Opened in 1924 by Ukrainian immigrants, this diner is better known for its pierogi dumplings, especially the ones stuffed with meat and cheese. They make 3,000 every day, but hurry up, they go fast. For Monocle in New York, I'm Santiago Rodriguez Tarditi. Будет рок-н-ролл.
You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24, and we'll stay in New York next to have a bit of a post-Tonys analysis with Matt Wolfe. Stay tuned.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews, and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
And welcome back. It's Saturday. You're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Steve Blumfield.
Well, before the break, we were in New York, and to end the show, we'll be staying there briefly, because last Sunday night, the winners of this year's Tony Awards were announced, not without a few surprises, and here to give us his take and tell us why American theatre seems to be taking over London, too, is Review regular Matt Wolfe, the IHT's theatre critic. Matt, welcome as ever.
Thanks very much.
Now, in a moment, I want to talk about the really big thing that happened at the Tonys, which wasn't actually any of the awards, but first of all, let's run through the awards. What were the things you were pleased about, surprised about, disappointed by?
Well, they were very democratic. The winners were spread across a lot of different shows. Sometimes you have a year where one show sweeps. You might have Once or the Book of Mormon or whatever winning 8 or 9 awards. This year, there was nothing with that kind of volume. So you had 6 awards for Kinky Boots, which won Best Musical. You had 4 awards for Matilda, which was probably many fewer than they would have wished. They were nominated for 12. They won 4. Kinky Boots nominated for 13, won 6. 3 awards for a much acclaimed revival of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the Edward Albee play. That was a bit of a surprise, not because it wasn't good, but because it had closed in March. And the feeling on Broadway always is that you should be running to get an award. And Tracy Letts, the wonderful leading actor in that production who won Best Actor in a Play, beat out people like Nathan Lane and particularly Tom Hanks. Mm. And everyone had thought, well, Tom Hanks would sort of get an award just for coming to Broadway. And the fact that he had come to Broadway in a play called Lucky Guy and, believe it or not, was actually good, was enough to double ensure he would get an award. But in the end, I think the voters thought, actually, you know what? Tracy Letts' performance was better. The Best Play Award went, as expected, to a sort of Chekhov-inspired mashup by Christopher Durang called Vanya and Masha and Sonia and Spike, or maybe the order is the other way around. It's one of these titles that everyone has fun with, and they had fun with it on the Tonys. So it was very egalitarian. It was a very nice Tony Awards ceremony from that point of view. I feel a little sorry for the 4 young girls in Matilda who were awarded a special Tony for their contribution to the Broadway season, but it actually wasn't part of the ceremony itself. So,
and it was interesting as well that the Matilda had done, I mean, it's been such a huge success that there was a feeling certainly amongst British critics that that Matilda had been sort of slightly unfairly snubbed because the Brits had been doing so well over in Broadway that there was a feeling that, well, we can't give it to, you know, them too many awards this time.
I think there was that, and there was slightly the feeling amongst some of the Broadway community, I gather, I don't share this, but that the Royal Shakespeare Company, who are the people behind Matilda, had been a bit arrogant in putting the packaging together for Broadway. In other words, they didn't let that many American producers in to have a piece of the pie. And on Broadway, everyone wants, of course, a piece of the pie. I don't blame the RSC. They're a state-funded company. If they're on a commercial roll with a show, they should jolly well make sure that they get as much of the profit for themselves as they can. But Broadway doesn't care whether they're state-funded or not. That's not Broadway's business. They just want to share the pie. Conversely, Kinky Boots, which, although, yes, it is based on a British movie from 2005.
Not a very successful British
movie. No, and probably...
or not very good, really. I mean, it's
okay. But yeah. I would bet you 95% of the people seeing the musical on Broadway have no idea it's based on a movie. It doesn't matter because it's one of these sort of belligerently feel-good musicals. They practically crawl into the audience and lick you to try to wrestle you into submission. And the big winner from that was not Billy Porter, the lead actor, although he did beat out Bertie Carvel from Matilda. It was actually Cyndi Lauper of Girls Just Want to Have Fun fame, who, of course, is a New York native. She's a Queens girl. And what she's doing writing a musical or scoring a musical set in Northampton, England is anyone's guess. She's probably as surprised as anyone else, but she made history by becoming the first woman ever to win a Tony for Best Music and Lyrics, which is impressive.
Theater is often the Cinderella to film, but now how does the U.S. media cover the Tonys compared to something like the Oscars? Is it getting the column inches?
Well, I think the feeling about the Tonys is that it's an urban interest event. If you're in New York, obviously, I mean, it's a New York story and it's happening in New York. But if you're in L.A., because a lot of these people are L.A. people, San Francisco, Boston, Washington, Chicago, the sort of obvious theater capitals that you might guess, whether it plays in Peoria or in Dubuque or in Podunk. Podunk is sort of the all-purpose American place name, isn't it? I don't know, and I suspect the Tony administrators don't really care. Interestingly, the ratings were up this year substantially, and that will make CBS, the channel that broadcast it, very happy, because I think there's always been the feeling that CBS is kind of doing Broadway a favor by agreeing to show them, because at the end of the day, this is just a minority interest. So if the ratings are up, and that may have been partly due to some of the nominees, Tom Hanks, Cyndi Lauper, Neil Patrick Harris hosting for, I think it was the fourth time.
Well, let's talk
very
about
popular.
Let's talk about Neil Patrick Harris, because when I said at the start, you know, the big thing for me wasn't who won. It was Neil Patrick Harris, who, for international listeners, you know, he's not really seen as a Broadway star. He's the funny one in How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah.
And things like that. But he was comparing, I think, yeah, for the fourth or fifth time. His opening number, the 8 minutes, the glory of the 8 minutes, which included Mike Tyson, who was surprisingly good in it, chorus girls dancing from pretty much every show. I mean, it was, I'm not doing it justice, but it was an incredible opening to a show, wasn't it?
No, you are doing it justice. I mean, and there was this, well, I mean, there was this fantastic collision of sort of little girls when you had all the little Muppets from Matilda kind of running one direction across the stage, trying not to collide with all the little Muppets from the revival of Annie, plus, you know, the high-kicking drag artist from Kinky Boots, plus Mike Tyson sort of kicking up his heels, but being very, very game. Why Mike Tyson, people may be wondering. The answer is that he actually had a one-man show on Broadway this past season, not nominated for a Tony. He wasn't going to unseat Tom Hanks, but he was part of the Broadway community, so it wasn't as random as it sounds. It was one of those great opening numbers of an award show that you sort of live in hope of. It was a big contrast to a couple years ago, the year when Rock of Ages, the musical, was nominated that season, and in the opening number, there was a piece, I think, a flying scenery that fell on one of the artists from Rock of Ages and led to a lawsuit. So this was very, very different.
And also the thing that was brilliant about it was that there was a real moment at the end where Neil Patrick Harris talks about the people that are watching.
Yeah.
And in particular, you know, says, you, that kid who's watching now thinking, yes, I want to do that. Mm. I was once that kid. Mm. We were all once that kid. Mm. And look where we are now. And it was a really touching moment in this sort of, you know, extravaganza of Broadway that you thought, yes, actually, this isn't just show, but it's about
something. I missed
something.
It live. So secretly, while you two are chatting, I pulled it up on YouTube. And just even without the sound, it looks amazing. And I want to kick my legs up and I want to go on the tread those boards.
You're getting me all choked up describing that moment at the end, because that's exactly it. It's, you know, you 8, 9, 10-year-old watching this, you may think this will never be part of your life, but actually it can become your life. It can take over your life. And it was wonderful. What would be really wonderful would be if Neil Patrick Harris returned to Broadway in a show. That would be great.
I thought you were going to say if he could host the Oscars.
Oh, well, I'd like anyone to host the Oscars compared to last year's debacle, but we won't dwell on that.
No, let's not. But let's talk. So, I mean, that was New York, and it's all very well and good, and that's great. But a lot of what we're seeing in New York is increasingly going elsewhere, and we're seeing it now at the moment here in London.
Yes. I mean, what's happening in London at the moment is twofold. You're getting the London transfers of New York shows. So, I mean, obviously the Book of Mormon at the Prince of Wales, which is still running very happily in New York. A play at the Bush Theater now in West London called Disgraced, which is a Pulitzer Prize winner that began in New York. But what you're also getting in London, which is a little different but still American, are British theaters deciding to trawl the American repertoire for titles that they think are interesting, partly because they're not seen in New York. So we've had several of those in the last week. The National just opened a production of James Baldwin's very important play from the 1950s, The Amen Corner, which in my experience has never been done in New York, certainly since I've been going to the theater. And it's one of the defining plays about Black American life, set at a Harlem church front in the 1950s, about a sort of female pastor who loses hold of her flock and who's sort of brought to ruin. And then just concurrently with that was a new production of Tennessee Williams's really extraordinary play, Sweet Bird of Youth. And that's the third production of that play I've seen in London. And again, it hasn't been done in New York since 1976. So I think the British interest in the American repertoire is really amazing and very heartening.
Do you think part of the interest is because the playwriting itself is so strong that it's great vehicles for actors and actresses?
I think that's exactly it. There's certainly with Sweet Bird of Youth and Amen Corner too. These are very muscular, rich parts. And it's not that, I mean, heaven knows, the British theater has plenty of those as well. But if you're Kim Cattrall, who's starring in Sweet Bird of Youth, and this is her fourth London stage appearance in the last decade, you're looking for things that are meaty, that really allow you to kind of show your chops. And if you're playing the Princess Cosmonopolis, who's an aging film star down in her luck, who ends up in a sort of Florida backwater with her young gigolo hunk, Chance Wayne, played wonderfully in this production by an American actor named Seth Numerick. I mean, you're going to go where the work is. And this is a role in a play that you're going to be offered here, probably not in New York. One of the reasons for that is it's got a big cast, and Broadway is very big cast averse, and they don't want to pay for all these actors. London doesn't mind.
Now, not all the theatre that comes from the US to London necessarily hits the spot. And David Mamet has a new play, Race, which is on at the Hampstead. And, you know, David Mamet's one of those names that people go, oh, that's David Mamet. I'll go and see that.
Yeah.
And yet, it's fair to say that, you know, a number of critics have been a little bit unsure about his recent work.
You're absolutely right. Mamet has been, I think one could, not uncharitably say, been on a losing streak of late, with probably his last five or six plays. His last Broadway play, which was just this past season, was a two-hander with a wonderful cast, Deborah Winger and Patti LuPone, and it closed after about 2 weeks, called The Anarchist. It was actually going to be done in London first, and that was scrapped. I haven't seen Race in London for the very simple reason that I did see it on Broadway with James Spader, and I wasn't particularly impressed there, and I thought, well, I doubt it's changed very much here, aside from a different cast. The title is incendiary. You think, David Mamet, Race. Wow, this is going to be very provocative. It's going to have the hair standing up in the back of your neck. In fact, it's actually quite bland. And when you think that this is the same David Mamet who wrote Oleana, who wrote American Buffalo, who wrote Glengarry Glen Ross, it's like a before and after. Something happened somewhere along the line, and he can't get back to where he was.
Was it film? Was he involved in film?
He's had a sort of political conversion, as you know. He's very anti-liberal. He's become very much a rabid right-winger by his own admission. He has all these theories about acting, and he's written books about acting, and he doesn't really believe in Stanislavski or anything like that. The language is there, just say it. And maybe he's getting too caught up in his own theory to really pay attention to the writing.
And do you think that there is a danger that in other theatre cities around the world, that they see a big name that's always been, you know, huge success on Broadway or in New York theatre, and think, well, I mean, this must be good because it's a name, or even, well, it might not be that good, but it's a name, so it will sell.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but there's always that question. If play X didn't have the title page on it with the playwright, would it be performed? In other words, if you didn't know this is by David Mamet, it just was put through your letterbox, you go, this isn't very interesting. Then you go, oh, my God, it's by David Mamet. We better do it. But in a way, I mean, more power to a playwright who is him or herself a draw. There aren't too many of them.
Well, indeed. We're going to have to leave it there, Matt Wolfe. But let's, you know, recap on a high note that Neil Patrick Harris opening to the Tonys, as Gillian's been watching it here, do go to YouTube and download it, because it's quite spectacular, isn't it?
Fab.
Matt Wolfe from the IHT, thank you very much
thank you.
Joining us on The Review. That brings us to the end of the show. Thank you very much for listening. It's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. The show was produced by Case Bilbao, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Georgina with a weekend edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And if you're in London this weekend, don't forget to pop into Monocle Country Fair at Midori House, which is on all day Saturday and all day Sunday.
And if you can't come down to London, do stay tuned to Monocle 24. We'll bring you some highlights throughout the day, including, I promise, in about 2.5 hours, me interviewing some animals. You've been listening to The Review with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Gillian Tobias. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.